Hello, and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone, a weekly look at the world of philosophy and at the world through philosophy. I'm Alan Saunders, and this week I want to talk about something I got to thinking after last week's show. You may remember that Dr. Jocelyn Dunphy-Blomfield from Monash University talked very movingly about her teacher, the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, who died a few weeks ago. I said at the time that Ricoeur, though a very distinguished thinker whose work was rich and varied, never achieved the fame of other groovier French philosophers like Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. So what, I wonder, do you have to do to be a fashionable philosopher? What do you have to do to be a philosopher whom everybody, or at least a lot of people, have heard of? Well, before we come to that, let's hear some more from Jocelyn Dunphy-Blomfield. One of the people who introduced her to philosophy was David Armstrong, later to be Professor of Philosophy at Sydney, but at the time teaching in Melbourne. Now, one of the ways to get to be a fashionable philosopher is not to be an analytical philosopher in the hard-nosed Anglo-Saxon tradition, which is what Armstrong is. So how did she find going from Armstrong to Ricoeur?
I did hear David Armstrong speak at a conference a couple of years back when asked about a particular problem that was being discussed. He replied, "Well, I'm still working on that," with a smile, and everybody laughed. I think that's what a great philosopher of any style has in common with another, that there is the interest to push and push to get the answer to one's problem. And this can be done in different styles. For example, the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who's also an analytic philosopher but very, very skilled in the French style too. He speaks French as many Canadians do. He has had great affinities with Ricoeur for many, many years, and at a celebration in his honour where Ricoeur read a paper, he replied to him, "Your work has inspired my own, and the only thing I regret in my book Sources of the Self is that it came out a year before your book, One Self as Another, and missed the main concept that holds yours together, otherwise I'd have used it." So I think that people from different, if you like, styles of philosophy, if they're motivated by that great and intense urge to pursue a problem and get to the bottom of it, will appreciate each other's work or will be equally or similarly admired by readers.
I'm always interested in the pupil-teacher relationship, and obviously your relationship with him was more than intellectual. I mean, there was a personality here that you were engaged with.
That is very true. But when you said at the beginning that he was not as well known as people like Derrida and Foucault, it's very interesting because I think what happened in France was that the famous event of May 68 marked an enormous generation shift in a culture that was a very traditional one.
So this was the student rebellion of that year?
Yes. His own sons, his two youngest sons, were involved in it too. And he had a lot of sympathy for the young rebels, really. At Nanterre, where he taught, there's a famous episode of the rubbish bin, which people asked me about last week, where some students emptied a rubbish bin over his head when he was dean at the time on the Nanterre campus. Nanterre was a bit like the Monash of Paris, the new university built way out in the suburbs where it was still all mud, and which is now, you know, part of a very well-built-up area. And what the problem for him was that many of his contemporaries, men in their early 50s roughly, were frightened by that period and became more conservative, perhaps almost a little reactionary, some of them. This comment has been made about the German philosopher Habermas. He was frightened by May 68. The new pope in the Catholic Church was a young theologian at the time, and it said he too swung back to a more conservative position then. Ricoeur continued with his work, but did have a lot of attacks from various sides, not just from the youth. And it was at that time he was invited to take on a permanent position at Chicago for half of each year. And he said that was really what saved him in a difficult time, as well as invitations to teach in different countries of Europe, Belgium, Germany, Rome and so on, which gave him a much wider scope. I think that probably the 68 period did mark a dimming of his star, if you like, in France because of the huge changes. but it allowed him to stretch what you could call his wide cultural tendencies and wide curiosity for the world in a way he wouldn't have otherwise.
Interestingly, David Armstrong had his own share of political troubles at Sydney University in the early 70s. But political engagement isn't enough to win you fame for your philosophy. Armstrong has a claim to being the best philosopher this country has ever produced, but he's still not a household name. Not like, say, Peter Singer, who is probably famous, notorious even, not so much for his arguments as for his conclusions about the status of animals, fetuses, the newly born and the terminally ill. So fame has little to do with quality. You can be a good philosopher or a not-so-good philosopher, and that doesn't seem to be the issue. But let me illustrate this with an anecdote, which is very possibly apocryphal. There's this London cabbie, you see, many years ago, and he says, "I had that Bertrand Russell in my cab the other day." And I said to him, "Hello, Lord Russell, what's it all about then?" And you know, he couldn't tell me. Those were the days when philosophers could be recognised by cab drivers. Actually, I did once have a conversation about Russell with a Sydney cab driver, but he was a student moonlighting while he wrote his thesis, so he doesn't really count. So back to the story. Now, there's nothing worse than a joke with footnotes, but I have to say that there are three interesting issues that arise from this. One is that the cabbie had philosophy more or less right. Philosophy does, in a sense, concern itself with what it's all about, with the totality of truth or knowledge, rather than with little bits of it. The little bits are the concern of physics, biology, history, sociology, and so on, which means, of course, that the little bits are pretty damn big. Another point is that when the cabbie asked the distinguished British philosopher what it was all about, he probably wasn't thinking of the totality of truth or knowledge. Depending on when the alleged incident took place, Russell might have said, "I favour metaphysical pluralism, but I'm much opposed to epistemological psychologism." Or he might have said, "I take the view that what we call matter is a logical construct out of sense data." I doubt, though, that this was the sort of answer the cabbie was after. He wanted something about the meaning of life, and that wasn't something that Russell was able to give him. Which brings us to my third point, which is really more of a question. Russell was a philosopher famous enough to be recognised by cab drivers. But what was he famous for? I don't think it was his sex life, colourful though it was. I think it was two things. One was being a very vocal atheist at a time when atheism spoke its name rather more quietly than it does today. The other was being the public image of a very clever man. He was to philosophy what Einstein was to physics. You didn't have to be able to understand what he was up to. You just had to have some apprehension that this was really clever stuff. Russell, rather more than Einstein, abetted this view of himself by supporting his income with the steady production of journalism and popular books. This is where you will find his ideas about the meaning of life. But do we really have to go there? Trust me, the really difficult, unapproachable Russell is infinitely better than the Russell you can understand. If there was an Australian equivalent to Russell in Russell's time, and I'm talking about public standing rather than philosophical significance, it had to be John Anderson, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Sydney from 1927 to 1958. Anderson had an elaborated philosophical system. He also had a sex life that was interesting, though nothing like as varied as Russell's. But what made him famous or notorious, I think, was, again, his atheism and his political radicalism. Well, we can argue about the significance of Anderson's philosophical work. Russell's is a bit debatable too, though I think pretty solid. But what are we to make of this?
Next question, I've heard the last one, from Miss Moore of Southgate. What is the difference between fresh air and a draught? Are we going to approach this from a philosophical, a medical, a scientific, or a physical point of view? Good,
Surely a draught is fresh air coming through a little hole and impinging upon a little bit of yourself. That's not affecting you equally.
Gould?
Sure, sir, the distinction is this. It is fresh air when you put the labour carriage window down yourself, but it's a draught from the person opposite to you.
Yes, I think we'll close on that happy blend of sociology and philosophy and psychology.
If this was a public meeting and I asked everybody who knew about the philosopher there to raise their hands, I don't think I'd see too many hands. OK, so that was a broadcast on the BBC in 1943, but even if I were talking to a British audience, I don't think there would be many hands going up. What you heard was a radio show called The Brains Trust, in which various intellectual worthies answered questions from members of the public. And for the public, the great philosopher was the one you heard there, a man called C.E.M. Joad. He was the guy with the rather squeaky voice. There's not a lot to be said about Joad. Colin McGinn, one of the more significant of philosophers in the English-speaking world today, has written about the significance of Joad to him when he was a schoolboy in the 50s. But he adds that Joad derived most of his ideas from Russell, to such an extent that Russell, asked to write a laudatory preface to one of Joad's books, replied, "Modesty forbids." The point is that in a day when radio really was a mass medium, how I long for those days, Joad was the only philosopher most people had heard of. He came on like a philosopher too. When listeners to the Brains Trust wrote in with questions like, "What is happiness?" Joad would say, "It depends what you mean by happiness," which sounds thoughtful, meditative, and philosophical. And that perhaps is what it's about, looking or sounding the part. Here on the Philosopher's Zone, though, I hope there's a little more substance on offer. I'm Alan Saunders. I'll be back next week, but for more of substance, stay with Radio National for Occam's Razor, presented by Robin Williams.